You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanham Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Nick Pacelli. He's an investigative reporter with Searchlight New Mexico, and his story about teen suicide can be found in many newspapers around New Mexico and at searchlightnm.org. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
So teen suicide, an incredibly painful emotional problem that's going on all over the country. How common is it in New Mexico?
It's very common in New Mexico compared to other states. It's important to point out that suicide is not everywhere. It's not a common occurrence. We shouldn't normalize suicide, so to speak. But New Mexico, especially among kids, has the fourth highest suicide rate in the country. And when we're talking about suicide by firearm as well, we also rank in the top five in the country.
There was a statistic in the piece that you wrote that something like 14.8% of middle school students in Socorro had attempted suicide last year. This is shocking. It's hard to believe.
Yeah, it is shocking to look at New Mexico's Youth Resilience and Risk Survey, I think it's called. The data in there, those who have considered suicide, those who have attempted suicide, are nearly double the national average. And in some pockets, like that statistic in Socorro, it's particularly jarring. It can be difficult to extrapolate, but that survey across the state goes out to some 16,000 students. So we can say with a certain level of certainty that there are almost 13,000 students in New Mexico at the high school level, for example, that have seriously contemplated suicide and are aware of the presence of a firearm in their home. And that's something that I think New Mexico Department of Health and Department of Education really need to reckon with.
Do we have any idea how these kind of numbers compare to the numbers 10, 20, even 30 years, like a generation ago?
Yeah. Youth suicide nationwide has really risen since the late 90s. It was particularly high in the early 90s. However, it's the highest we've seen it in 40 years across the country right now. And in New Mexico, in 2017, the most recent year for which data is available, it was the highest youth suicide year we've seen since we really started counting in the late 90s.
You tell the really heartbreaking story of a 16-year-old Albuquerque girl named Aura Gardner who took her own life about 2 years ago. She was 16 at that time. She was an honor student, musician, creative artist, lovely person, came from a caring, loving family. How did you go about writing this story and sort of exploring what happened to her?
It began as a lot of long conversations with her mother, looking into the life and objects that she created around her. I flipped through her class assignments across every subject. I flipped through her sheet music where she would just make a ton of notes. I've talked to her orchestra teacher, her social studies teacher, her sisters, and as many people who were willing to speak to me about the life she led, which was that of a very high-achieving, reticent young woman who led a fairly, I would say, average life in Albuquerque with a very nurturing household.
And, you know, and you write about this a little bit, people want to blame somebody or blame something or blame the system or whatever. Sometimes it's a story of bullying. Often we hear these stories about a kid who's bullied and then takes his or her own life. This case is a little bit different in the sense that it's hard to point a finger at a single thing. How do you understand the big picture of what's going on?
Right. I think that's part of what drew me to Aura's case, is that there's very little that you can clearly extrapolate from her story. It resists any easy interpretation, as you mentioned. And as research often points out, suicide is one of the most complex things you could look at empirically, especially suicide by firearm, because there's such a small survival rate. So in digesting Ara's story, you really have to look at a myriad factors of what she was dealing with at the time, the rather quick sort of descent she had towards her final decision, and a bunch of environmental factors around that I think the country and the state are grappling with, which, you know, is a very high anxiety and depression rates among kids. Although Ara had no diagnosed history of mental illness. She was just a highly stressed student, something that I think is reflected in what we saw in the suicide clusters in Palo Alto with some degrees of separation. But again, her story really stands alone in illuminating the real complexities of this issue.
And it unfolds like a Greek tragedy in the sense that there was a firearm in the house, but it had always been locked up until recently when there had been a spate of bald-faced robberies and the gun was sort of taken out for safety's sake.
Right. And that's something living in New Mexico, growing up in New Mexico, that, I mean, outside of the context of suicide, I'd heard about a lot. A lot of people have unsecured guns in their home. And once it is unsecured, many people stop thinking about it, that it's there.
Right.
There's a high petty crime rate in Albuquerque, for example. And I talked to several families who said, yes, once our teenager became of a certain age and they had been certified to or gone to a gun training, essentially, at a range or something for youth. And they said, that's sort of the culture we live in, where we told our kid where the gun was in case someone broke in. However, research shows us that that's not the wisest decision, as we can't truly know in a lot of cases what teenagers are thinking. And if you are really fixated on the mental health of your teen and how you could help them and nurture them and get them help or get them resources, it's easy to forget that you have an unsecured gun somewhere in your home or that they know where it is.
And basically, studies have shown that if you lock up those guns or get them out of the house, it really does have an effect on teen suicide.
Correct. A great quote I got from Victoria Wad Reed, who's at New Mexico Department of Health in the School and Adolescent Health Office, said, if we locked up all of our guns in the state, we would cut our suicide rate in half for kids and adults. And that's true. It's not feasible. She did point out that we should focus on all lethal means, but guns are fatal 85% of the time or more. All other means are fatal less than 15% of the time.
So a kid might take, or an adult might take pills and with the intention of committing suicide, and it doesn't work, so to speak.
Yep. What some experts and researchers are calling an epidemic is the rise of especially young women attempting suicide by poisoning or some drugs. Very seldom, less than 5% of the time, are they successful, but their rates are rising incredibly. And so it becomes ever more important, in my view, for states to have explicit programming on firearm means prevention if you live in a state where firearm ownership is very high.
There are countries, I mean, I was talking to a friend in Germany who said, it's mandatory that our guns be in a safe. Like, mm-hmm. What are you guys thinking?
Yep. New Zealand put out a landmark study, in some people's view, on firearm access for kids and suicide specifically. And they were among the first to show that if you lock up all your guns in a county, for example, your suicide rate will go down. I mean, that's something we see reflected across the state. What's interesting is that at the Department of Health level across states, we don't have research that shows whose suicide prevention plan works. Is New Mexico's better than Utah's? Is theirs better than Colorado? We don't really have research showing whose plan is the best, but we do have research showing that programs that focus explicitly on firearms within their larger gamut of suicide prevention efforts are successful in lowering suicide rates.
Now, there's an interesting example in Torrance County. What's going on there? Does that provide a counterexample?
It does. I mean, Torrance County culturally is a little bit different than, you know, some of our city centers. Rural, agricultural, and to quote some folks out there, everyone and their grandma and their grandpa have a gun. Guns are shared among community members. They are part of life in Torrance County. Torrance County also has very few behavioral health practitioners and not very many options for anyone struggling with mental health. However, they've only lost one teen aged 10 to 19 to suicide by firearm in the past 10 years. So, and I talked to some folks out there, they've had success with selling gun locks to families and getting people to use them. But as some people told me, the gun is just more respected. The damage that a gun can do is more respected among their teenagers, is what I heard from talking to people out there. And with that, that's how they reasoned that they aren't losing kids to suicide by gun. And I did look through every, in reporting this piece, we looked through every coroner's report of every youth that took their own life with a gun in New Mexico going back to 2010. And a great amount of them are in city centers, not a lot around Carlsbad or Roswell or Moriarty or Edgewood. So having those numbers can really inform how we look at addressing the issue, I think.
How does it inform how you look at addressing the issue? I mean, is it cultural? Are there problems inherent to cities? Are the kids not spending enough time outdoors? Like, what's going on?
I mean, I think that's a national conversation we're having right now about increased depression and anxiety rates in students. I think a big part of this piece is dispelling a lot of the old myths about youth suicide. It's no longer really the tale of a bullied young kid or young woman. There are still high rates for LGBT individuals, but in the records I was reviewing, very few cited instances of bullying in police reports or in coroner's reports. A lot of them cited easy access to a firearm in their home or in the home where they were living at the time. And very few cited a previous mental health history. So it's becoming more difficult to spot, I think, if that tells us anything. And intervention, while, like, and for example, Albuquerque Public Schools' intervention numbers are going up, it's mostly going up at the middle school level and not the high school level. So how we get our high school students to talk more candidly and destigmatize this issue, I think, is really important.
When you say destigmatize the issue of mental health in general or suicide, or what do you mean?
I think suicide, mental health in general mental wellness, anxiety, depression. I think we're often talking about how teens interact in digital spaces, how they're dealing, how resilient they are with life changes. And mental health practitioners are often talking about how we can give teens more tools to deal with the ebbs and flows of their young lives.
I mean, one of the things that I can't help but think about is, you know, when my generation was young, even though I did not really grow up in the countryside, we spent a lot of time outdoors. And kids who were living in quote-unquote digital spaces, as you say, a disproportionate amount of their lives. I mean, things are happening physiologically. They're not moving their bodies. They're not looking at the horizon. They're mm-hmm. not smelling each other and spending time with animals. I mean, right. do we know these play a role?
You know, I can't speak specifically to research on, you know, I'm sure being outdoors and being more connected, human connection, not digital connection, can be very valuable for kids. One thing that I kept referring to in my reporting was studies, empirical clinical studies with kids who had attempted suicide that went to the kids following their attempt and asked them to generate a list of five people who would sort of be some sort of like their accountability or guardian folks following their attempt. And putting that decision in the hands of the kids showed that there were extremely few repeat attempts or any suicidal ideation. So I think something needs to happen where kids realize how siloed they are if they live in a digital space primarily, and how important it is for parents to be thinking about giving the power to their kids to recognize who they want themselves to go to if they're in a moment of distress. Because oftentimes, I think a lot of kids encounter moments of distress and they turn to their friends on social media, which can feel, there could be a closeness that you feel there. But in fact, I don't think that's actually there. I think being able to go speak to adults that I, the teenager, am choosing as people who I am connected to, human connection has shown to prove that kids see that they are not alone and they are wanted by people.
Yeah.
Something that's missed in suicide among kids is that, we see from research an average of 135 people are directly impacted or feel the impacts of any one suicide.
Well, that's the thing. It's such a tremendous and painful and sad and long-standing ripple effect,
right,
in that person's community. And in the case of Ora Gardner, she went to a school where there was kind of a disproportionate number of suicides in her particular high school. And the staff and the teachers are struggling to try to understand what's going on.
Yeah. El Dorado is a fascinating school for me to look at. I grew up in Albuquerque. I knew a lot of people that went to El Dorado and younger than me that still do. They are really struggling to figure out what's happening. I can't prove this because APS doesn't track this, but I'm very confident from the reports we've reviewed that El Dorado has lost students more consistently than any other school at APS. One student to suicide every year for the last 4 years, and teachers say that students have actually left the school and gone on to take their own life, and so that could be within a near term that they left the school, so that could be considered a community loss. I think the teachers are a often forgotten part of this conversation. They have to go back to classrooms of 30, 40 students after a student is lost, knowing that this class of students lost a classmate last year, and they knew that another student was lost to suicide the year before. And so they're not happening in close enough proximity to each other, I think, to call it anything like contagion, but it is deeply felt at El Dorado. I talked to over a dozen students who graduated this past year who were in Aura's class, who took classes with her, who were just maybe not necessarily close friends with her. But a lot of them cited just this deep feeling of anxiety to the point of suicide would always come up if there were crows on the soccer fields. Because it was just, I hate to say that students told me that they felt like they were like the cursed school for some reason, because they are not. They're actually working really hard to address this. And I give their principal, Martine Sandoval, and their staff a lot of credit for their resiliency in all of this, because they are grappling with this. I know the teachers are asking APS to not repeat QPR trainings every year, which is a sort of a national awareness campaign that counselors give to teachers and students, because it's the same information year after year, and it's a little bit costly. So teachers are asking, because their students are asking, what is going on? We need to change this in some way, how we're focusing on this issue, how we're talking about it with our students. Some teachers say we need more of a community schools model, likely to connect students to outside adults and make them feel or make them realize that they are needed and wanted by a wider community.
Right. And that kind of reestablishes something which has been considered old-fashioned for a while, which is not only sort of academic transmission of learning, but real emotional connections between adults and young people.
Right.
Which is human.
Yes. I mean, it is interesting. I can't totally disqualify digital connectivity. There are great studies and clinical trials, largely with military vets, that show, and with people who have attempted suicide. There's a great Huffington Post Highline piece by Brian Cherkis about this, about how small messages of support can have tremendous impact in saving a person's life who is considering taking their own life. So it's not to disqualify talking to people with like nice Facebook messages or emails, which Aura's mother did in her final weeks to try to keep her spirits up in some way.
Yeah, she did all the right things.
Yeah.
Very consciously.
Yes. She sought out outside help when she really couldn't get a hold of the counselor's office, as she said. And I talked to several students, one student in particular who is anonymous in the piece, who left El Dorado after a long fight with depression, and he had so many absences that the school had to take disciplinary actions to pull him into an office and say, why aren't you showing up to school? Because if you miss a class at El Dorado, it's an automated system that calls your parents. It's not a person. And absences, sleeping less, disassociation are really key warning signs that our schools should be looking at. And in this case of Ara's case, and in the case of this other anonymous person, it was very hard for them to get a hold of the school, to get in to see a counselor. There aren't necessarily secretaries at these counselors' offices anymore. So there's not a outward-facing person seeing kids who come into the office sort of on a whim and want to see someone. They sign up at a computer, and then they're sort of called. So I think at schools, it's hard to say. I can't just say because funding is a huge issue, right? But I think these kids need more human connectivity, human faces, and not logging into a screen to try to talk about something related to your mental health at school.
That's right. What was it like for you as a reporter to approach this family and start talking to them? I mean, it's such a, in a way, private and vulnerable space.
Yep. I think I approached the family very carefully, I hope with a lot of empathy. I think I have a great rapport with Carrie Ann and her daughters, Ara's mother and sisters. They're 2 years out from this, which is by no means a long period of time when you're dealing with sort of the limits of reason when it comes to suicide. I tried to establish early on that this family was getting support. The younger girls go to the Albuquerque Grief Center during the school years every week or every other week, and basically sit and do activities with other kids who have lost family members. And I think that's actually a great resource for them. Something that struck me early on in the reporting is just how candidly this family speaks about suicide, how comfortable they are sort of in the dark corners of talking about suicide. Very candidly. And that really struck me and really allowed me to report this piece as thoroughly as possible. It's not easy to talk about why your older sister who you looked up to for so long, who was always had her sort of head in the trees among birds, like go into her mother's bedroom and shoot herself. But they do it with some aplomb and assurance, I would say. Of course, they don't slip sometimes, as anyone would, into sort of self-reprimanding questions or questions of if Carrie Ann was neglectful, even though a court and police detectives found that it was a tragedy without fault. Anyone would, I think, slip into that, but it was very difficult to report this piece and sort of delve into the psyche of this family. I think that's almost two separate pieces.
It's very painful and a very beautiful piece that you wrote. And I just want to sort of end with a tribute to this lovely young woman, or a gardener who, as you said, would sit in trees watching the birds all day and play the cello and write poetry, and by all accounts would have been just a wonderful, incredible adult.
Yeah. In the reporting this, I did go listen to some of her past like cello performances or solo performances. And it is really a really moving thing to do because music was the most important thing to her. And I think we end the piece by saying that Ara's memory doesn't only belong to this mother, but a generation of young people right now grappling with this issue. And I think the piece does stand as a tribute to her in some ways. And yeah, I don't know.
What did you come away with after writing this piece yourself?
I came away with a lot of preconceived notions about suicide dispelled. I came away with a tremendous amount of respect for teachers, especially the teachers at El Dorado High School. And I came away wanting to continue to look into this issue as frankly and openly as possible, and to hopefully open up a conversation with people who work on this issue about how, as a community, how communities can be flexible and amenable to change to address this issue, and also talk about the role firearms play in it candidly. That's something that a lot of communities will not do.
Well, we look forward to more conversation as time goes by. Nick Pacelli is an investigative reporter with Searchlight New Mexico. They're at searchlightnm.org. Nick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy, elevating interest and opportunities in STEM. Visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lanl Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.